The Late Debate with Katie Hannon on RTE Radio 1.
Another man dies on the streets of Dublin as housing continues to convulse the body politic. On Patka objection to cheese plant prizes open fault lines in the coalition. From here to maternity, hospital access still an issue for partners. And are we on the cusp of full-scale war in the Middle East? All that and more on tonight's Late Debate. But first the news with Shane McGowan. Thanks, Shane. Good evening and welcome to Wednesday's Late Debate. Joining us tonight, we have Fianna Fáil TD for Clare, Timmy Dooley, spokesperson on Climate Change, Transport and Communications Networks. Cathal Berry, independent TD for Kildare South. Senator Roisin Garvey, Green Party spokesperson on Rural Development and Enterprise, Trade and Employment. Anthony Flynn, independent councillor for Dublin Central and co-founder and CEO of Inner City Helping Homeless. And Craig Doyle, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. We want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie, or you can tweet to @latedebate_RTE. Now, sadly, tonight there is reports that there has been another death on our streets. A man believed to be homeless was found dead in Dublin city centre earlier today. If confirmed, his death would bring the number of people known to the homeless services to die this year to 40 so far. Anthony Kelly, that's a tragic new record high, isn't it?
It is. It's I suppose the first quarter of this year shows that we've seen the highest number of deaths within homeless services ever seen before. Last year we saw 79 in total for the whole year. So only last week we spoke about, I suppose, the rise in the number of people that are dying within homeless services, and a lot is attributed to mental health issues and so forth. Unfortunately, the number this year is very, very high. Again, tragic that we heard of another death then today, that man passing.
Dara O'Brien did raise questions about how we're counting these deaths. Is there something happening that more people are dying, or are we counting the number of people in this category in a different way?
Well, I suppose the categorisation and the recategorisation of homeless people, they've been recategorised minister to minister, really, within the quarterly reports. And the Deputy Chief Executive in Dublin City Council Monday said that they aren't recategorisation is not happening from them, that it's coming from the department. So the exits and the entries are coming from the quarterly report from the department. But again, those that are dying, we have a serious increase in the amount of single males that are entering homeless services. We're seeing on average 3 people enter homeless service a day, although the number of families is reducing at times. And I think we saw for the first month the number of single individuals reduced last month. But, that has been a consistent rise over the last year, and particularly through COVID, where we've had people that are being, I suppose, into hostels that are on 24-hour lockdown, really, through COVID-19. The mental health issues and the supports that are not there within those facilities. I did speak with the director on Monday and the deputy chief executive in regard to what we need to do in regard to moving towards a trauma-informed care model within homeless services, and ensuring that we have the proper wraparound support services for everybody that's there.
Can I ask you about that question that was raised in recent weeks about the provision of tents to homeless people? I'm so conscious that over the last couple of weeks we've talked about houses and 3 beds out in Maynooth, and we've talked about 2 bed apartments and 1 bed apartments and all of that. But for this particular cohort, these tents are their home.
So I suppose the issue with tents has always been there, but the fact of the matter is that we've moved from the provision of service from the NGO sector to the private emergency accommodation sector. These people that are providing our beds now, up to 65% of the beds that are being provided in Dublin are being provided by private emergency accommodators. These are people that are here for profit. They're not here from an NGO point of view. The Deputy Chief Executive himself admitted the fact that we're in a position where the same wraparound support services are not provided by those providers. Now, I have a serious issue when we have people that are leaving hostels and they're going back out onto the street into tents because of the level of service that they're being provided.
And so do you think that we should be giving tents to homeless people?
We definitely shouldn't be giving tents to homeless people. What we should be doing is ensuring they have the proper services provided to them. And I think the move...
Should we be taking tents off homeless people
services? Definitely not. What we need to do is move towards a proper housing force model in the city and ensure that those people have access to the appropriate services that they need.
Are you worried about what happened when the eviction ban that has been in place while we were under level 5 is lifted?
Yeah, 100%. I think we're in a position now where, with the eviction ban being lifted, although there are restrictions in regard to those that can be evicted from premises, if you have lost, if you've lost your job from COVID, you still have that protection. But that protection is only to a very small number of people. We're talking about 200,000 people that would have lost their jobs. If we look at the percentage of people that will come from that might claim to enter homeless services. But we've got a whole cohort of people that are entering homeless services on a monthly basis. This is the first year that we've actually seen the numbers come down, and that's purely because the eviction ban has been in place, in my opinion.
Is Darragh O'Brien the man for this job, do you think? I mean, he has spoken very sympathetically about the plight of people in hotels and on the streets.
Look, I've met Darragh through Lord Mayor's Homeless Task Force, and I think that, you know, we're in a position where we've seen too many ministers go through and too many ministers not getting a hold of their brief going through the department. We've seen consecutive Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, governments in place. You know, this line that have only been in office 7 months and they haven't had a position in terms of getting a hold of their brief. Darragh O'Brien might not be in his office in a year's time when, you know, we see Leo Varadkar become Taoiseach, and there's probably a reshuffle of cabinet that'll happen there. What we need to do is ensure that we have somebody with a bit of longevity in that office to ensure that everything that they're implementing is going to be followed through on.
When the debate raged again last week, Timmy Dooley, it was about young people in apartments and families trying to get into houses. And to some degree, this is the very, very sharp end of the crisis we find ourselves in.
Well, with respect to everybody, they're two very different issues, and this is the really tragic side of it. And I think, as Anthony has rightly identified, it's not providing a set of keys to somebody in a particular situation who, through, as a result of mental health, perhaps some accident or injury, are, you know, trapped in addiction, and they find themselves homeless on the street, living rough, and oftentimes, as I said, with mental health and addiction. So it's not about the building of homes won't solve that problem. They need that service. And I read some stuff recently about what's happening in Finland. And they have a particularly good model.
That's housing first.
Housing first.
Homes will solve a lot of the problems,
It's not about, but it's about the services, because you hand a set of keys to somebody who's homeless and you give it to them for nothing. They may still die within the building. It's about trying to address their mental health issues. It's about trying to address, in many cases, addiction. It's about trying to show support and solidarity that gets people into some kind of a functioning lifestyle that manages to get them through it. But for sure, the situation is exasperated when there's a shortage of homes and when you have families in hotels. I stay in a hotel when I'm up here, and I regularly meet people who, through no fault of their own, have found themselves unable to afford the rent in a home, or the house they were in, or the home they were in has been is about to be sold or is sold, and they find themselves outside the net. And that has to be addressed through the building of homes and houses.
I was going to say, I mean, you're talking about this as if homelessness is it just street sleepers.
No, that's what I said.
A very small cohort of what has now developed into a massive.
Yeah. And we know tonight, I think there's probably 8,000 people. And usually the breakdown of that is about, 50% of it are children in emergency accommodation tonight. And that's a shocking indictment on everybody in public office across this state.
You know, I mean, I'm old enough to remember Simon Coveney when he was minister giving himself a target of the following July that there would be no child in emergency accommodation for the following July. I see Darragh O'Brien saying that ending child homelessness is possible in the next decade. And eventually phasing out private emergency accommodation. It's hardly ambitious, is it?
I think it's realistic. When you look at the...
Really? We could be looking at children in emergency accommodation in 5, 6, 7, 8 years from now.
The important thing, Katie, is the length of time that they're there, because there will always be a certain group of people who will find themselves, through no fault of their own, evicted or outside, out of a home. It's the length, it's how long it takes to get them back into a structured tenancy that's really important. So in my view, there will always be a certain cohort of people, no different to people who lose their jobs. The real test is how quickly the state can intervene and ensure that there's the stock of houses there in the first instances.
But we're talking about this now. This is a perfectly normal situation. Yeah. But up until 8 or 9 years ago, up until 2013, really,
Katie,
we didn't have a scenario where we had whole families falling into homelessness and ending up in hotels.
458 children have been in homelessness for 24 months or more, in accordance to the quarter one report that came out. So 458 children have been 2 years or more living in a hotel.
Like,
or
that is shocking.
That's the point.
Shocking.
And the
statistic.
Only way that can be addressed is by building homes, both social and affordable, and in increasing the supply across the entire marketplace that meets meets the needs of a growing population. And sadly, there, you know, as a result of the one of the very significant fallouts from the financial crash, we have lost a lot of our builders. We have lost a lot of our experienced craftsmen. They're outside the country. Even with the best will in the world of the government right now to get projects up and running, it's taking time. And the really difficult aspect of that is that people, unfortunately, have to end up in emergency accommodation. And I think the plan that's being brought forward at the moment by the state, the programme for government, sets out very, very aggressive targets, very ambitious targets, I might add.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that in one moment. I'll just let you in there, Roisin, before we leave this issue.
Yeah, I suppose it's just horrific. I mean, I have to thank Anthony for all his work. I know him from outside of this room, from the great work he's been doing. The people on the ground know best the reality of it. I think the very important point he made about wraparound services is key, because if you know, he's referred to it himself, but there's no point in just showing somebody into a hostel and these, the private emergency accommodation suppliers, I mean, it should be mandatory for them to supply some other supports as well. Otherwise, we know that's going to end up back on the streets. So that's a huge issue, I think. I know from the Green Party perspective, we've been pushing the cost rental model, which, because there's so many different levels to homelessness. You know, there's been the rent hikes mean people can't afford it, they become homeless. And, you know, if you look at the cost rental model, that it's called the Vienna model, it means that the houses are built and you rent them out at the cost to cover the cost of the build.
What did you think when last week Dara O'Brien started talking about possibly getting other ways to fund cost rental and bringing investment in from other sources, which surely would completely undermine the whole concept of cost rental?
Look, the bottom line is the houses need to get built. We have a shortage of houses as well. I mean, we've a shortage of houses. We also have a shortage of houses that are livable in. We have, you know, we've very lots of derelict sites and we have poor quality houses as well. I think maybe I think we should talk about the retrofitting plan and looking at bringing people out of fuel poverty. And I think it's really important, you know, to highlight the fact that we want half a million. We want all social housing retrofitted first, and that's a top priority of ours.
Let's just, while we're moving on to this now, so I just want to give people a flavour of how this housing debate on a macro scale rages on in the Dáil. Here's some of the exchanges from earlier today, starting with Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald.
We are in the grip of a housing crisis, which is a social crisis, indeed a social catastrophe for people up and down the length of this state.
I think if there wasn't a pandemic, we would have boots on the street. People would be out. There would be people on the street protesting at this point, because there's a whole generation that have just simply had enough.
What you need to do is exclude the cuckoos and vultures that Michael Noonan and Brendan Howland invited into this country in 2012, 2013 and 2014.
My focus and the focus of the government is to deal substantively with the issues and to make sure we can create more supply. Because more supply is what is required. We are simply not building enough houses or apartments in Ireland at the current time.
Now, that was the Taoiseach ending that taste of the exchange in the Dáil today with what you might say is a statement of the bleeding obvious. We are simply not building enough houses in Ireland at this time. Half an hour ago, Sinn Féin's Eoin O'Brien tweeted, "Coalition of shame, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Green Party voted to stand with vulture funds and for sky high rents. They blocked Sinn Féin's plans to stop vulture funds buying up family homes, cut rents with a month's rent in their pocket and ban rent increases for 3 years." Can I bring in Cathal Berry on this? Cathal, did you vote on that motion this evening?
I did indeed, Katie. I voted with the Sinn Féin motion. Look, I was actually, I suppose, torn, because there was two motions down, and this is rarely mentioned whenever these debates come on. So the opposition put down a motion and the government generally put down a counter motion. And basically what the government was saying is they actually have proposals with the Office of Attorney General at the moment, and they're being road tested and being staffed by the office, and they'll probably release them in the next few weeks. But I guess the Sinn Féin motion, there was some, I suppose, more specific targets there, and that's why I went with the Sinn Féin motion this time out. But I think my own personal view is we need to look at a more whole of government approach to addressing the housing problem. Yes, it's true that the Department of Housing should be in the lead, but other government departments should be playing a supporting role. Like I was in the Curragh camp this morning, my professional and personal home for decades, and it's incredible to believe that there's approximately 100 houses there, wholly owned by the state, run by the Department of Defence, lying completely idle. And that's completely unacceptable, that one government department during a housing crisis is not properly managing their housing housing stock, and that needs to be improved.
And that's managed by the Department of Defence, is it?
Correct, yeah. 100% owned by the Department of Defence. And they're little things. Look, some of them are in turnkey condition. Others would need 10, 20,000 euro to
And why aren't they being used by... this is army housing we're talking about, is it?
Yeah, correctly. And I mean, like, my office is in Newbridge, so every single day we're getting four or five queries from military families who are on the social housing list for Kildare County Council. And to me, that's unacceptable, because the department do have within their means and capabilities to address the internal military housing crisis themselves. And they shouldn't be dumping all these people on the housing list for Kildare County Council. Every government department should be playing their part.
Absolutely. Let me bring in Craig Hughes. Craig, this just blew up in an extraordinary way after a year of being basically in a slumber, this row.
It did, and sadly the situation got worse. I think we know from the ESRI research that we need to be building 33,000 new homes a year. I think this year we'll be lucky to get to around between 15 and 20,000. Last year was a similar number, and similar the year before that. Now, today in the Dáil, the Taoiseach said, look, I would like us to be able to build 40,000 homes a year, which again, stating the obvious, but the problem with all this is, and the story we ran earlier in the week in the Irish Daily Mail, was that the Department of Housing don't think we'll hit this target of 33,000 new homes until 2025. So if you look at that just from a big picture supply problem for the government, it's really difficult to see.
Say that again, Craig. The target of...
So we need to build 33,000 new homes each year to meet demand.
So right. it'll be 2025 before.
And yeah, exactly, before you even hit that for the first time.
That's all things going well again.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you take into consideration that we needed to be hitting that target for the last few years as well, so we're already playing catch up on that target. So from a supply point of view, the government is really up against it. And they'll say, as any housing minister will say to you, you know, we can't magic houses, we can't make it happen overnight. So it's a real difficult challenge for the government now, how they're going to go on for the next 4 years in this government and trying to defend policies against Sinn Féin and have little to show against it. So I think one thing that they might look to do could be perhaps for renters, that might be one area where they might be able to say, OK, this is one area we can get a win. So Dara O'Brien has a rent reform bill coming in the autumn, for example, where they'll look at rent pressure zones, whether they need to keep them or tailor them. So I think if I was looking from the outside in, I'd say that's one area where the government will look to make a serious move to try and appease voters in that regard.
Will they hang separately or hang together, do you think? Because already there's, I think, signs of cracks in the coalition in relation to this. I saw John Lahart, Fianna Fáil TD, writing in your paper last Saturday, having a right go at a key pillar of the Fine Gael housing policy from the last government, the strategic planning areas.
I mean, John made a very, I'm told, made a very impassioned speech at the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party last week, where he said that the party were drowning in Fine Gael housing policy, and that if young people in his constituency would be out in the streets if it wasn't for COVID, and he said he'd be there with them. So it gives you a sense of the unease within some of the government parties. And even when this issue first came up about the cuckoo funds, for example, the three government parties were split at the time on how to deal with it. I remember the morning that it was being discussed, I was at a doorstep with Eamon Ryan, and it was put to him that we should go with Dara O'Brien's previous bill to limit the supply of houses that can be bought up by such funds, and he thought that would be unconstitutional. And then you'd some elements of Fianna Fáil saying, no, this is how we want to go forward. We then had the housing minister saying, no, this should be a tax issue. We'd Pascal Donoghue saying, well, hold on, it's not that simple. So all of a sudden you could see for a long time with this government, everyone was in it together because it was a very easy goal to fight against the pandemic. Now all of a sudden we start seeing the different ideologies come into play when it comes to serious issues like housing.
Yeah, indeed. Timmy Dooley, the second we move off COVID, the gaps, the cracks are beginning to go. Let me just say, if you're the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party this evening, heard apparently, were you there?
I was.
Or you were online, obviously.
I was zoomed in.
The Taoiseach said that Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue and Housing Minister Dara O'Brien were progressing solutions regarding the problem of institutional investors competing with first-time buyers.
He did. and I understand from the ministers concerned that they are progressing it. And look, I just want to refer to that motion tonight. I didn't read it, but I know the fake content of it. And it was an effort, and that's politics by Sinn Féin, to steal a march on the government, to put forward a bill that they knew would never be implemented, would never get the support. And as Cathal has identified, the government made it very clear tonight, but it doesn't make the headlines, that they're working through the legalities of a proposal that will be road tested to the extent, the greatest extent possible, that you don't end up with unintended consequence. There's an old saying, and you're well familiar with it as a political journalist, that rushed legislation is usually bad legislation. And if it takes a week or two to get a bill that's robust, won't be subject to challenge in the courts, and will deliver a rebuke to the cuckoo funds, well, then that's the right way to do it. I was having a conversation with a friend tonight, and we were just discussing how issues like this arise on an annual basis. Every time the Finance Act or the budget is produced, the hawks within the tax planning world look for opportunities to make money for their clients. That's what they do when they're trained in that regard. And the revenue are very quick to identify loopholes, and they bring forward proposals to tighten that up. And I suspect we're going to be dealing with that in housing for a while, because now that these funds are located here, they have a role and they have a relevance.
Was it the right thing to do, what Fine Gael did, to give them that very generous tax treatment?
I think it had a limited use, because quite frankly, there was need for high density, multi-unit, apartment complexes in the city centre. There was a demand and a need, but it was very difficult to get finance to build them because it's risky, and some of them lost money. So there was an opportunity brought in with the tax incentive, no different to what was done previously to get companies to go in and build offices in areas that were
okay. Unfortunately, I think most people are more familiar than this than they wish they were at this stage.
Correct.
In terms of what happened. But
yeah.
Was there a point at which that tap should have been turned
there
off?
There was.
When was that point?
Where I got really concerned when I saw funds buying houses and starting to own them and leasing them back to the county councils. I thought that was the beginning of a difficult period.
That's been going on for
when that became the norm, just to get your social housing mix, and it was the funds were buying it and leasing. If the state was buying it, fair enough, but the funds were buying it, they saw the opportunities. They started packaging those and selling them on as a financial product to other more stable pension type funds. When they then saw an opportunity to do that with houses that were effectively first-time buyers, because they developed a product, they needed more supply, and they were getting it, and that's when it was in my view out of kilter and should have been addressed.
So when was that, do you think?
I'd say within the last 3 years, certainly. Now there's still a role for these funds, because we need to get money from somewhere to build the houses. Kids.
Yes, your housing minister.
They can get the money from somewhere. So let's not we're circumvent, and we can go to Europe. We can go to European banks, and we can get the loans now, very very cheap rates. Okay, so we can get loans for literally nothing at this rate.
No,
the problem is the Pascal Donoghue who doesn't want to put those onto his loan books, because it affects his market, it affects GDPR.
He can't. Under
but of course
European
he can.
No,
he
growth, the Growth and Stability Pact is there. Now, Sinn Féin and others will gloss over what we have signed up to from a European perspective in keeping stability within our economy and the capacity of the state to borrow. Like, if it was as easy as that, it was just a matter of ringing up the European Central Bank and saying, load on the cash, we'd be building houses.
But isn't that what we're doing at the moment?
Because we're doing that now at the moment. Yeah, and that's an arrangement across the Union.
Of course it is. And there's arrangements across the Union, and across other European countries where they are doing the exact same thing, taking monies from Europe in order to build social and affordable housing. But we seem to be the only country that's not doing that.
And the level of indebtedness that we have makes it difficult. So we have to come up with
how
did
we end up with the level of indebtedness?
Yeah, but that's fine. You can go back. We can have that debate and I'll have it with you. But the reality is we're in the position that we're in. We need access to capital to build houses. Now, there are some people within, and I'm not suggesting you because you understand it well and you know well, we might look at things differently, somewhat ideologically. But I get the impression, particularly within Sinn Féin, that there's a desire for nothing to happen here because it suits an agenda, which is why you will see. And the Taoiseach made it very clear.
There's nobody from Sinn Féin here to defend themselves there. But in fairness, that is an extraordinary.
Well, then why did Sinn Féin object to up to 5,000 houses across various different planning applications over the last number of years? You'll have somebody on from there again. Let them answer that.
Because it leads back to the private funds.
We haven't referred to yet.
It leads back to the private funds. We're in a situation where we're being turned into a country.
We're being turned into a country of
renters, and what we're doing is we're feeding and lining the pockets of these private funds. We've seen a 97% increase in the cost of housing since 2012, and that's been under successive Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael governments. So there's no excuse.
clues for that.
Yeah, it's very hard, I'm sure, for people out there to listen to the Taoiseach, listen to yourself there, Timmy, tonight, to basically say this is a problem of the opposition's making.
No, I'm not suggesting that.
Well, that is what you were just suggesting about.
Katie, with the greatest respect.
And that's what the Taoiseach was saying in the Dáil today, wasn't he?
There are people putting forward a simplistic approach to the resolution of this problem. Okay. I'm saying it's complex. I'm saying there's efforts being made right across different political parties. But it was my comments were born out of a motion run through the Houses tonight. And
did you think it was cynical?
Well, I think it was political. But then for Eoin O'Brien,
is there a difference?
Well,
Roisin's been trying to get in for some time.
Just on the whole issue, it is vast and it is huge and it is a disgrace, but it is also complex and there isn't one simple solution. And I something we haven't referred to tonight, and I'll give you an example down in Clare. We have two shovel-ready projects for housing to be built, one in Broadford and one in Milltown Malbay, but we have no water infrastructure. So, you know, if you pair it back, there is also a huge issue. You know, if we don't deal with our water infrastructure crisis, we won't solve the housing crisis either. And that's something that we have to address as well if we want to deal with homelessness and housing. And I think that's really important that we looked at. Not only are we going to have to, you can't build a house unless you've got water and good water treatment and good water facilities. So that's something I wanted to bring into the debate because I think that's really important as well.
Cathal.
Yeah, look, I just think the solution is work on supply and work on affordability. They're the two factors. So from a supply point of view, look, we still have to beat this pandemic, keep the construction sites open and get houses built. The only thing I'm not in favour of is not building houses. And we have to build houses and everyone has to work together to get houses built. So we have to keep construction sites open. And I think every town and village in the country has some kind of construction that's kicked off in the last 2 weeks. And that's a symbol of hope. And we have to keep this going. From an affordability point of view, then, yes, we have to work on the fiscal side and make sure the appropriate tax arrangements and the planning arrangements are in place to incentivise proper housing, safe housing being built in the appropriate locations for first-time buyers and anybody else that needs them.
Okay, just give you a sense of, again, we're getting a big reaction to this housing as we've done every night. We've done it now since we came back on air. My family took part in the plan of campaign, the Rising, the First Dáil, the War of Independence, the Civil War, all for control and ownership of these lands. Why should we or any of Ireland's newest citizens tolerate destructive landlordism and excessive rents in this beautiful republic created by our ancestors, says Sean in Dunleary. I'm a landlord, says another texter, with two empty houses in a city suburb. They were let for over 20 years, but when I saw the tax breaks for foreign investment compared to the 50% income tax I pay, I decided to exit the market. That is a huge issue, actually.
It's a huge problem.
Timmy.
It is, yeah, something that I have spoken on both internally within the party and externally, because the vast majority of landlords across this state own one or two properties, and there are many unfortunate landlords that have ended up with a property because they weren't able to get what they owed on it, and they were forced into effectively renting it out in the hopes that it would regain value, and quite a lot of those have exited the market. And the reality is that they're for
it
every
must
landlord
be so
for the rent
sickening
that comes
for
in,
them now to have this highlighted yeah. now that the very very favourable and generous
well,
tax
it's highlighted for
that
them
these
it's highlighted
are.
For them for a long time because they know it. They know that they pay 50% of the rent that they get in tax to the state, and I think those landlords have been, you know, unfairly treated. I can see what the government tried to do at the time by bringing in these funds because we were in a very difficult and a very different fiscal position. The country was broke. We were trying to pay back. You can go through all of that.
Yeah.
But the reality is there was money needed and it was needed quickly. The domestic banks were broke. I think the mistake that was made was allowing them to go beyond their initial mandate.
Was that the only mistake that was made, though? Because I'm looking at the housing figures, the house price figures that were released today by the CSO. First of all, in a pandemic with 400,000 people on the PUP, we see house prices rising 3.7% in the first 3 months of this year, the fastest rate over the last 2 years. But the other figure that actually really jumped off the page for me was that house prices in Dublin are now 97.8% higher than their lowest point in February 2012 after the crash. So that the job that was done there in reinflating house prices have brought us right back to the place we were when people were paying what we were. We still talk about as those crazy prices.
I just gave you that figure of 97% in terms of the price of housing, but the rents between 2014 and 2019
have doubled in that time. Rents have doubled and people in that position.
Was it a success of a policy, but the wrong policy? Well, there's two things. When you go back to 2011, house prices were probably below what you could build a house for because of the economic crisis at the time.
2012 was the lowest level.
So they were below. A lot of people were in very significant negative equity. So the house prices had dropped below what it would cost to build houses, which was created a lag and a delay because it took a while then for the building sector to come back and build houses and be able to get a price for them that covered the cost of construction in the first instance. That took a number of years. You talked about 400,000 people being on the PUP, and that's correct. But don't lose sight of the fact that there are a lot of people whose wages were never impacted during the pandemic. For the past year and whatever, 400 days, have been not able to spend money. There are very significant deposits in banks as a result of it. This time of the year, there should normally be somewhere by about maybe 3 to 4 billion of personal savings on deposit. I think it's close to 17 or 18 billion on deposit in domestic banks at the moment. So that'll give you some sense of the amount of savings that are there. So I'm not surprised that house prices, with the scarcity in supply and the amount of additional savings that people have made over that period of time, that it's also having another negative impact on house prices. And that's just another difficulty that's handed to policymakers that they now have to try and find a solution to.
How much is an affordable house in your view? Where should that be set?
Well, it's relative to your income, Katie. And as you know, the prudential limits that are
now set. Affordable housing now that the minister has identified is 450,000.
That's not
that
true.
That means he came out and said that.
He didn't.
And then we're in a position where if that's the case where it's been identified as 450,000 as an affordable house, we need a couple of 55,000 euros per year each. That's 110,000 coming into a home. And to have a deposit of 45,000 euros in order to go and get a home. Now, I know from my constituencies that there's nobody in my constituency or very few people in my constituency in a household that are earning 110,000 to be able to afford a home with that
rent. But that said, now with respect, and I agree with a lot of what you say, but that's disingenuous to say that affordability is set at 450,000. It's set in one district, the most expensive place in the country to buy a house.
Where most of the people in the country live.
If I could just come in there, Katie, with respect.
There's patches across this city that the limit will be set lower. And it's about bridging the gap. It's not saying that the person can afford 450,000. In that constituency, I assume, you know, you have a couple that are on 50,000 each. That allows them to get that house, and the gap is filled by the state taking a share in it,
which shoots up the prices.
In the likes of my constituency,
yeah. What does that do? In the likes of my constituency.
Well, no, it isn't. Because it is. Because they're already selling. There's already people in that area who are buying the house. You're trying to give the person who's earning a reasonable income a chance of owning a house against people who are better off in the same constituency. In the area that I know best,
Timmy
of Clare, two
do
people
you
on
accept
40,000.
What the ESRI, the central bank, Robert Watt, who else, the housing agency, do you accept what all of them have said about that particular policy?
Do you accept that it will lead to an increase in house prices? I have seen no other proposal come from any other side that says to me in the constituency of Clare how a couple, maybe two teachers, on 30,000 apiece, maybe a nurse and a guard, whatever it might be.
So you've no issue of landing that couple with a second mortgage effectively that they will have to pay back eventually and possibly feeding into the increase in house prices for everybody else in Clare who's looking for housing.
As you know, there are many people who go for a starter home and within 5 years they move to a more expensive house because either through promotion or progression within their careers. You or I aren't on the same wage
people
that we were when we
jobs,
started. Yes, they do. And then they end up staying where they are and there's a capacity.
And then they have a second mortgage.
Yeah, and they end up having to renegotiate and work through. But the general progression is there. And that's just the way it is. But to suggest that 450,000 is set for across the state when it's set at 230 or 240,000 in most constituencies.
Give us those constituencies because I'm not aware of them. 230,000.
Well, the list is there to be published. I don't have it in front of me. But
sorry,
you're back to Mr. Google
just to say the cap for this for an apartment in Dublin is actually €500,000 for an apartment that goes up to that price. And I think the issue that people have is, obviously this is a cap, so there are things available, you know, in the middle ground. But I think the main issue people have with this is that if you set the cap at 500,000, it's going to drive prices below that up further. So that means even if you're not in this affordable scheme and you're trying to buy in the private market, you know that the prices are going to be inflated because the state has taken such a share in this. And this has been warned against, as you said, Katie, by the Central Bank and the ASRI.
I suppose that's where the cost rental model might be more useful as well, because, you know, we can't get everybody to own houses forever. When you look at the scale of the problem around housing, it's not all about owning houses either. When you talk about the people who are actually homeless, I think the cost rental model has to be really valued here, because if you've got a security of tenure, which is the key thing that people want, you know, in the rental sector, and you have got a model where the rent is going to be kept affordable for a long, long time. We see this working in other countries, that it's a model that people feel reassured and safe. And the huge issue at the moment is because people can hike the rents up. Now, sometimes they have to, but in lots of cases they don't have to. And that means you get shoved out of your house, basically. And that's a lot of the reason why you have families in hotels. It's to do with the rent hikes. Whereas the cost rental model will stop that from happening.
And I know, and of course, your party leader has spoken about this for many years and has been driving for this policy, and it is in this bill. But is it ambitious enough, what's in this bill, in relation to that?
Look, it's part of the solution. The Land Development Agency will see more public housing built on public land, and it will see more cost rental housing built as well, which is an important part of the solution. It's not the one thing that's going to fix
all. What about that element?
All.
What about the element in the Land Development Agency, which says categorically that if that agency is acquiring land from another state agency, which is public land, that they have to acquire it at market value? Is that not going to fundamentally increase the price of that housing for everyone? Yeah, is that not an issue?
I suppose if you're going to do cost rental on that, it will still be affordable because the cost is taken into account of the actual value of the site as well. But yeah, I mean, I don't know why it would have to be set at market value in every instance.
Why would, if you're paying huge amounts more for that land, won't that be, have to be, that'll go into the rents of those tenants in that project later?
But the main focus of that is to look at, like, council-owned land and public lands and to make sure the local authorities get to build houses, which is another huge issue, because I was talking to the Director of Housing today, and it's got so complex now for local authorities to build houses, and it takes so long that they're frustrated as well. And we've kind of disempowered local authorities in building houses, and we need to really look at
that. The LDA have disempowered all those, taken the power from the elected members in terms of one of the only provisions that we have or reserve functions that we have left is in regard to the sale of lands. You see what happened with the likes of O'Devany Gardens and the deal that was done up there with Bartra Capital. It's absolutely ridiculous. The Dublin Agreement Group signed off on that land sell-off. There's been a proposal put to the Minister in regard to the Oscar Traynor lands now at the moment. And, you know, parties have worked together in terms of Dublin City Council and looking for the Minister to sign off on that land to be built off. And what happened there on that sell-off was a situation where councillors actually went back to management and said, no, we're not going to go with your mantra anymore of selling off our lands to private developers in order for those private developers to build houses and lease them back to us. You know, the LDA is not something that's going to work, in my opinion.
Why?
We're in a situation where they're going to basically source the land from public lands that are available. They're going to give it back to private developers. They're going to give it to private developers for probably a knockdown price, and then
they're going to give it to the housing associations and the local authorities as well. It'll be free public land.
What they say is that they have both the public and a commercial wing. You know, what I've seen since I've been elected to council is that the majority of state-owned land is being sold off to private developers, and the land is being leased back, or the houses are being leased back to us at extortionate prices. On 25-year leases.
Can I bring Cathal in there?
Yeah, just briefly there. You were looking and you were discussing just a couple of minutes ago in relation to the definition of affordability. And it shouldn't really be associated with the cost of a house. The international benchmark is a maximum of 30% of your income. Yeah. So if you are paying more for accommodation than 30% of your income that's coming in, then you are in an unaffordable property. And if you're paying less, then you're paying an appropriate fee, basically. So that's the benchmark. It should be a percentage of your income rather than the cost of a house.
That's not the way it's being set now, in particular in relation to this affordable. It's about a discount off the market rate, and of course the market rate gets set by whoever. And the market rate is completely distorted now because of the price people have paid for land to begin with.
But your borrowing rate is set by the prudential numbers of 3.5 times whatever your income is. So that will set it for a lot of people.
Kate, can I just come in there on the Land Development Agency? I actually spoke with the Chief Executive today, as it happens. He was quite keen to point out that, you know, while those powers are there to take state land and bypass councillors, that it isn't going to be the normal practice every time. And he pointed to the work they've done in Shingana already and said, look, we worked with councillors there before we had these absolute powers. And he said, even though we have the powers there, this is how it's going to work. And he said, it's not going to be a pillage of state lands. Now, look, whether councillors accept it or not, I mean, it's still early days for the Land Development Agency yet. But I think once the legislation has been passed and that before the summer recess, I think the government again will be pushing that forward as something that will be progressing their housing agenda when you start to see, you know, cost rental, that's seen as a big win for the Greens, and other affordable housing, suddenly having the sod turned to them and progressing.
Okay. I want to leave that there because I want to move on to that other issue that has blown up over the last couple of days. This is the... on Taoiseach's objection to Glanbia's €140 million cheese processing plant. I see Tipperary TD, Joe Cahala has, no, Jackie Cahala has characterised this objection as treason. He said they have no understanding or regard for the importance of the agri sector, and he demands a full review of public funds to the organisation. And of course, this follows Taoiseach Micheál Martin's urging that no further appeals be made against the project. This is because An Taoiseach decided to appeal a High Court decision dismissing its challenge against the decision of An Bord Pleanála to grant planning permission for the plant. Green Party TD Stephen Matthews today, Minister Roderick O'Gorman, both had something to say about that, and basically suggesting that the Taoiseach's comments were not appropriate. What do you say, Roisin?
I think that there's a judicial process there, and Taoiseach are going to use it. I think, you know, it's never black and white. An Taoiseach could do a lot of things besides objections. I would have worked with them in the Green Schools programme for many years. They do clean coasts, they do tidy towns, they do national spring clean. I don't think we should be getting the daggers out just because they're trying to make things done to make sure it's done right. And that will be proven in the courts.
Was it appropriate for the Taoiseach to make those comments in the Dáil yesterday?
I was surprised he did. And I was surprised.
You're being very diplomatic, Roisin.
No, I mean, I was surprised.
Was it appropriate?
I don't know. Was he cut off the hop or what? I'm not sure. You know, I wasn't there. I don't know what the context was. I was surprised. I think we should stay out of that and let the judicial system take its place. I think the agri-food sector, you know, this isn't going to give any better prices for the farmers for their milk or anything like that. It's not as if this is a big win for the small farmers in any way. The Glanbia plan, we know where the money goes. It's not going into the farmers of West Clare, I can tell you, or the farmers that are working hard and borrowing loads of more money to expend this ever-ending growth of milk demand. So, you know, I
what
don't think it's
that,
as simple as Taoiseach, don't get the farmers, and Glanbia are all there for the farmers. That is just not the case. We have the same price for milk as we had 20 years ago.
Timmy Dooley, what about that Jackie Cahill suggestion that we should review public funds for An Taoiseach?
Well, I think in this instance, An Taoiseach have overstepped their remit. An Taoiseach undoubtedly have a role to address the...
I'm thinking, danger here now.
They have a role to address the local environmental issues where a plant is being stationed, or a house, or whatever it might be. No issue with that. This is national policy. The agri sector has
where
suffered
is
and
it
will
said
suffer.
That An Taoiseach don't have a role in relation to national policy.
Well, I just wanted to finish the point. The reality is that the agri sector has been hugely impacted by Brexit. The Irish dairy sector exports an inordinate amount of cheddar cheese to the UK. That's no longer financially viable. So this particular dairy decided to look to produce a different type of cheese, Gouda, up to 50,000 tonnes that could be exported to different markets. An Taoiseach have deemed that this will somehow impact on our emissions and address our climate change plan, which passed second stage in the Dáil tonight. With that legislation, we'll be introducing carbon budgets, and it will be for departments and different groupings within government to decide, you know, what we do in relation to our carbon emissions. It's not for An Taoiseach to police national policy in this regard. So I think, and if you look
you
at
you say,
well, actually, the High Court said the same thing. With the greatest respect to everybody, they didn't think that it was appropriate in this instance to be addressing what is effectively a national policy issue. And, you know, you can't have it both ways. If we're going to set emission targets to meet our 2030 and 2050 obligations, which farmers are buying into, and then on the other hand, you're dictating whether or not or there's an attempt by this particular agency to dictate whether or not we should go ahead and move from producing cheddar cheese to Gouda cheese. It makes no sense. And I think the Taoiseach was right to express his annoyance at the particular event that has happened.
Okay. The other thing the Taoiseach said in relation to this is that his position remains very clear that project is of immense economic importance to the region, but also to the dairy industry and to the expansion of the dairy industry. Should we be expanding the dairy industry when we're looking at, now you said this climate change bill passed second stage 117 unanimously.
117-12, and you know, what when the bill is finally passed, what happens is each sector has to look at what they have to do. I don't know if the ever-expanding dairy industry is where we're going to be moving. I don't get that from farmers themselves, the ones I meet around. It's not what they all want to do either.
But is it worrying for you, Roisin, if the Taoiseach of the day, on the day before this climate bill passes second stage, is talking about how we need to expand the dairy industry?
Yeah, it's quite shocking. I don't know if he means to expand in different ways, like Timmy's suggesting there about different cheeses. As I said, I was really surprised by his comments. All I know is that we have to do our best, and this is not going to serve the farmers any better. You know what I mean? I think Glanbeil might be the big winners here, but I trust the judicial process. Let's just see what comes out. Maybe they have an interesting case. I mean, I don't know who decides when you don't take a case against Unborn Planola, and when you do. They're not the first group to ever do it, and they won't be the last.
Carl.
Yeah, look, I'm a big believer in freedom of speech. So, look, every entity and every individual in the country is quite entitled to take an appeal against a High Court ruling. That's absolutely their prerogative. Now, whether they choose to exercise that right is entirely up to themselves. Similarly, the Greens are entitled to their views. And also, if the Taoiseach of the day is asked a specific question in the Dáil chamber, I would be very, very concerned if he doesn't answer it in an honest way. So,
Is the appropriate answer? I mean, the Taoiseach took, as I recall, Holly Kearns to task and told her it was inappropriate for a politician to be intervening in the planning process when she was raising the issue of the baby graves in Bessborough and possible planning or possible development on that site. So is it why is it okay then for the Taoiseach to express that opinion?
First of all, I'm presuming the Taoiseach doesn't want to interfere in the planning process at all, but he is entitled to his personal view. So in relation to separation of
powers... Well, it's hardly
powers,
a personal view now if he says it on the floor of the Dáil as Taoiseach.
I would say it is. I mean, he's entitled to his personal view like everybody else as well. But one thing I would say is, in relation to separation of powers, the court case is over. We're in a new process now as a result of the appeal that was submitted. Now, the big point is that this appeal should be fast-tracked and expedited as soon as possible. And let's get a final decision and let's implement that final decision as soon as possible thereafter. That'll be my personal view anyway.
I think there's another issue there as well when the public are looking from this from the outside in. I mean, I looked at the Oireachtas Register of Interests filed for 2020. I mean, Jackie Cahill actually has shares in Glanbeil. You know, he's one of three government TDs who have shares in it. We put them this evening. So, I mean, I think it's a bit rich for, you know, a government TD to be raising this at their PP when they actually have an investment in the company as well.
With respect, Greg, I take a point. Jackie Cahill, in the first instance, let's be honest now, is a dairy farmer. He was president of the Irish Creamery Milk Suppliers Association. He would have shares by virtue of having been a supplier over time.
I'm sure.
Just
to be clear here, because Jackie again isn't here, right?
Well,
what did Jackie say in response to your call with him today, Craig?
It was my colleague who was dealing with that, and they also spoke to the two other TDs who have. Who are listed on the register of interest as well. And I just think as well, from the public looking in, you know, when they see this, I mean, it's not great for politics, I don't think.
Do make the point there about...
I think we have to be careful here. I mean, Jackie Cahill is a dairy farmer. The people who elected him on that basis. He's known the length and breadth of Ireland as an advocate on behalf of dairy farming. So I would expect him to say what he believes, and it's appropriate. The fact that he owns shares in the dairy,
really
those are co-ops, by the way.
Constant expansion of the milk industry, you know, who actually wants it? Because the farmers around me are only expanding because they're making so little money, they feel they've no other choice. I mean, who is looking for this?
I take Roisin's point, but Ireland has a mix of farmers. There's mixed farmers with small holdings who are depending
really
on the suckler
ones.
And the suckler herd. But there's also a commercial, a very significant number of farmers across the country who produce dairy, who produce milk, who, as a result of that product in the first instance, It creates a lot of employment in the various different processing factories.
And so a lot of emissions.
And a lot of emissions. And I think the agriculture sector is fully aware of the implications.
It provides half a job per farm. For a lot of small farmers, it provides half a job. Most of them have to get a second job.
Yeah, they do. But what they produce, whether it be beef or milk, creates a lot of employment in the various different processing sectors. So it's a very significant employer across the state, and we have to be careful. Yes, the emissions have to be addressed, and we have to look at mitigation, whether it's planting more trees or looking at the way in which we manage our land base.
But we're no way going to curtail the expansion of the dairy herd.
Okay. Well, we're certainly not going to cut...
Craig is 100% right. From the public looking in terms of conflict of interest in regard to shares in Glanbia and wherever else, that doesn't look good. But look, I think that the Taoiseach probably is new to his role, and he's probably got a bit confused there today. You know, the legal process is
again,
the legal
but just
process.
To be clear, that wasn't any secret. That was on the Dáil.
But the legal process is the legal interest. Process. Mm-hmm. And Roderick O'Gorman was right in terms of leave the legal process to iron out and not interfere with. The Taoiseach, I don't believe, should have interfered with the matter at all.
Okay, we will leave that there, and we'll take a break, and we'll talk about what's happening in the Middle East after this.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, finally tonight, we turn to the Middle East, where there are fears of a full-scale war. The death toll continues to rise, with a growing number of civilians getting caught in the crossfire between Hamas and Israel. I'm joined on the line now by Professor Paul Rogers from Bradford University. Good evening, Paul.
Good evening, hello.
Thank you for joining us this evening. Can you tell us why this time the stakes are raised?
I think it's the level of anger on the Palestinian side and the determination on the Israeli side not to give way on this. It has been developing for several weeks now. And I think the origins, of course, was the case brought by potential Jewish settlers to take over a Palestinian settlement, Sheikh Jarrah, in East Jerusalem, quite near the city itself, not far off. And this was seen by Palestinians as almost a kind of ethnic cleansing. It hadn't actually happened, but there were a lot of disturbances, a lot of anger. There were claims of harassment by settlers. There were counterclaims of Palestinians essentially rioting. And it came to a head, I think, very strongly when the police decided to intervene very forcefully and to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is probably the third most holy place in the whole of Islam. And that led to very strong feelings on the Palestinian Arab side. And that's where the Gaza situation developed with the initial rocket strikes two or three nights ago.
Could this take us into a full-scale, all-out war?
I think it could get a lot worse, but not to a full-scale war, because essentially while the whole situation between the Israelis and the Palestinians in Gaza is hugely asymmetric in military terms. I mean, the Israelis are almost a military superpower, and they could do almost what they wanted. But it isn't as easy as that, because obviously all they rely on, if they're relying on bombing and drone attacks, then that looks very bad to the outside world, and there's a huge cost on the Palestinian side. But the Palestinians in Gaza seem determined to hang in. If the Israelis were trying to put military troops into Gaza itself, then the last time that they did that in 2014, it went very badly wrong, and they took quite serious casualties, because Palestinian paramilitaries were very effective in defending what they saw as their city. So the Israelis really are constrained in a way, and while Netanyahu is basically speaking up and the rest and certainly going for the airstrikes, I think to have a full-scale war involving a ground war is unlikely, because that would almost certainly bring in Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, which has many, many thousands of rockets and missiles which it could fire. And that would be a very dangerous escalation overall. But that doesn't mean we're not going to see a lot more violence, because there isn't the will on the Israelis to stop, and there's the will on the Palestinian side is to continue to, as they see it, to resist.
And of course, this is a huge regional issue, but a hugely complex geopolitical issue. Just talk us through what's at play here in terms of the US and other players on an international level.
Well, I think the principal player, as you put it, is the US, and people are looking to see what Biden is going to do. So far, Biden has done very little on this issue. He has restored some of the funding for the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, which basically aids Palestinian refugees. But in most of the other areas, he's not made a move. He hasn't allowed the US consulate in East Jerusalem to reopen. There's no talk of moving the embassy out of Jerusalem again. And there are a number of other issues which Biden is not moving on, much to the disappointment of pro-Palestinians and the Palestinian people themselves. That may change in time, because I think what is commonly not acknowledged in current circumstances, the only state which has real influence on the Netanyahu government is the United States. And it had a very straightforward ride with Trump, who is very strong in their support. We simply don't know what Biden is going to do. Other states are significant, and I think one of the things we cannot yet understand is the extent to which the Israeli police assault in the Al-Aqsa Mosque will play badly in much of the Arab Islamic world, and that may include some of the Western Gulf states. Now, the autocracies in the region are not hugely bothered one way or other, but the anger within their populations may be different, and that may be something which is difficult for some of the autocrats to handle and may be a worrying sign for the Israelis as well. Although I'm bound to say that the current Israeli government seems to be absolutely set in its ways and not willing to give at all.
Indeed. OK, we will obviously be watching that very closely, a very dangerous and volatile situation there in the Middle East. Professor Paul Rogers from Bradford University, many thanks for that. I have a few seconds left. I want to just ask you, Cathal Berry, did you spend any time in that part of the world?
Yeah, I worked as a UN peacekeeper over in Israel, in Lebanon and in Syria. So I would very much agree with Paul's assessment there. That's absolutely spot on. Just in relation to solutions, we have the Israeli ambassador coming into Leinster House tomorrow morning at 9:30. He's coming before the Joint Directors Committee on Foreign Affairs and Defence. And the message we'll be delivering there is we need to move towards de-escalation as soon as possible, a temporary truce followed by a more definitive peace settlement afterwards. And that's the way to go from here.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that. We're right out of time. Tonight's programme was produced by Caroline Dalton. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Jamie Doyle was on sound. I want to thank my panel for this evening. I want to thank you all for listening and hand you over now to Cathal Murray on Late Date.